This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. My next guest loves robots. As a robotics PhD student at Carnegie Mellon, he designed helpful robots, the kind of systems that could help him help an elderly person live at home, for example. So you might be surprised to learn that there's nothing this roboticist likes more than imagining how it could all go horribly, horribly wrong. He does all of this imagining through his other love, writing science fiction novels. Daniel H. Wilson is the author of the best-selling sci-fi thriller Robopocalypse. In that novel, self-driving cars turn against their passengers, domestic robots murder their masters, and a self-aware intelligence named Arcos tries to wipe out humanity. Certainly violating Isaac Asimov's laws of robotics, but there's more. In his new book, Robogenesis, Wilson asks what happens after the inevitable robot rebellion. How will humans adapt to a world where the line between man and machine is increasingly blurred? Daniel H. Wilson is the author of Robogenesis. Welcome back to Science Friday.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we talk about your new book, I have to ask you, with all of this sci-fi in Portland, what's with this? So you have Ursula Le Guin lives here. Frank Herbert, who wrote Dune, lived here. You live here. Is there something in the rainwater that's going on?
Yeah, and Neal Stephenson is up in Seattle. It's the whole Pacific Northwest is really inundated with water and also with science fiction authors. It's a tough competitive place to write sci-fi. And I think the rain just keeps us inside enough that we have no other choice except to continue to write more novels.
And the new book, Robogenesis, is a sequel, as I say, to Robopocalypse. Where do you go after Robopocalypse? What more can go wrong than I've read that book. It's a great book.
So with Robopocalypse, you know, the idea is that there's this technological singularity and you have this artificial intelligence that does not treat humans very well. And so there's a war. And in Robogenesis, I pick up right as this war has ended, and what I'm really interested in is exploring the AI aspect of this. So, you know, in Robopocalypse, there are a lot of different types of robots that are out there. There are exoskeletons and spider tanks, and I had a lot of fun exploring all the different physical incarnations. In Robogenesis, I went back to how machines think and what would they want. And how would you survive in a world with these titanic intellects, you know, that are out there with their own motivations?
Well, what do you mean by talking about an apocalypse then? It's not really an apocalypse for the robots.
Yeah, you know, the term apocalypse is interesting, right? When people say apocalypse, they typically mean the fall of civilization or basically life as we know it ending. And when you think about technology, every new piece of technology that shows up changes the way we live. And I feel like in this age right now, with every new piece of technology we have to learn how to deal with, even the transportation and everything in our cities are fundamentally changing. We're living through lots of mini apocalypses. We're constantly adapting to a new world. And the trick is, you know, to take them a little bit at a time so that everything doesn't fall apart like it does in my novels.
And they do that quickly.
It's when it comes up on you too fast, that's when you get in trouble.
Yeah. Yes. What were some of the real robots that you have worked as a roboticist? What were some of the real robots that inspired you writing this new book?
Well, you know, I end up watching my friends and colleagues from Carnegie Mellon at the Robotics Institute, and they've gone off, and now they're all professors, and I have a friend who drives the Curiosity rover, and I'm very jealous of them all on a fundamental level because I only write about the robots now. You know, you look at some of the stuff like from Boston Dynamics, which is now owned by Google, which is kind of frightening on its own, but they had lots of quadrupeds, you know, and they're working on mobility, so humanoid robots that can walk around. And you,
like Big Dog?
Big Dog is a great example. There's a cheetah version. And you know what really hit me was when you watch these things, you realize that they're defying the definition of the word robot. They're not robotic. They look like animals. They look like people because they're moving so naturally. And what you realize is every animal is really the solution to a problem, which is how do you survive in a certain ecosystem or in a certain environmental niche? And when an animal is really good at surviving in that area, we look at that animal and we see what we call natural grace. It just looks beautiful because it's a good solution to a problem. When a deer bounds through a forest, that's an excellent solution. Robots are starting to get that.
Now, why does a robot have to look like an animal or a person?
Well, it doesn't.
Why can't we accept what it is? It's a machine, you know?
Well, it's the scientist's, you know, first instinct is to simplify the problem and look for the answer that's already out there. And as it turns out, if your goal is to build a robot that's going to be operating in a certain environment, then you can just go find an animal that operates in that environment and you can draw inspiration from it. And so a lot of times machines will sort of resemble animals, but what are we going to do? Make them all run around on three legs? Or there's pretty clear solutions to these problems.
Like Robbie the robot.
yeah.
You remember Robbie?
Arm waving.
Yeah,
technology.
Arms waving, a little light, like a bubblegum machine on his head. That's, remember that? Tell us about the slug bot. This really blew my mind.
So you know, I was talking about the seeing natural grace in robots, and it got me thinking a lot about machines that are kind of coming into our ecosystems. What would it look like if you had a feral robot who could go out into the environment and survive? And so this slug bot is part of a class of robots that go out and they have a sort of a biomass combustion. They're able to find plant matter, or in this case, slugs, put it into a chamber and draw energy from it, kind of like a stomach. And so, you know, the slug bot, the idea behind that is it goes out, it picks up slugs, it fuels itself so that it can keep on picking up slugs.
And this is, really exists.
Yeah. There's another one called the Eater, the Energetically Autonomous Tactical Robot. And this one forages for plants, but of course the press started running with this, and they decided that since it had military funding, that what it was going to be designed to do is eat corpses, right, off of the...
And this is not science fiction anymore.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, it's not designed to do that.
Did they really talk about that, eating corpses?
The press ran with that. That's not what it's designed to do, but it's like... It's what I call nightmare fuel, and I'm constantly on the lookout for that, you know, for my novels. So, sometimes I get away from what people are really trying to do, and I put a little bit of a spin on it.
Just a little.
Well, you know.
Did you find when you were designing and writing your robots, did you have a problem with Asimov's third law of robotics, which said, right, the robot cannot attack its master?
You know... So the three laws are really fun to think about, and I think that they're great because they get people thinking ethically about robots and how people are going to interact with them. But the real problems that you face designing a robot that's not going to be dangerous are a little bit more mundane. I mean, so it's more of a consumer, you know, it's like a product design problem. You know, the question is, you're going to build a toaster, you're going to put it in someone's house. What are all the ways people are going to find to kill themselves with the toaster, right? Because they're going to find a lot of ways. And it doesn't really matter what you put in someone's house. They're going to find a way to get killed.
That happened with the microwave oven. People started throwing stuff in there. And
people are amazingly inventive and suicidal. So with a robot, you have an even tougher problem because it's not an autonomous tool that's going to be maybe moving around in the environment. And so, you know, it becomes a lot more difficult to physically make sure that it's going to be safe. And then there's also there's an ethical dimension as to how human beings are going to interact with the tool. And especially if it's a lifelike robot, it looks like a person or an animal. Mm-hmm. How is that going to affect development? And what's your obligation to ensure that you're not warping people's sense of right and wrong?
You know, Rod Serling used to do this on The Twilight Zone all the time, didn't he? Robots in a couple of his episodes used to attack their owners, and so people have been thinking about this, about the robots taking over, I mean, for quite some time.
Yeah, and that's kind of makes it tough for roboticists. You know, this is a field where we've got 100 years of pop culture momentum for something that didn't exist,
right.
And then suddenly you're building it in a lab, and everybody's, it's like if you were suddenly building the Wolfman, and everyone says, I got a bad feeling about the Wolfman. I feel like I've seen this before, and it doesn't end well, you know. You have to say, no. He's going to help you walk. You know?
Be optimistic.
Yeah.
Be optimistic.
We're swimming upstream a little bit.
But there are good robots, right, in RoboGenesis, that are the ones that they understand humans. Is this something real? The real roboticists are going to have to do to teach robots human values and make them better citizens, so to speak?
I think absolutely. I mean, if robots are going to interact with human beings in our environment, then they're going to absolutely have to, you know, behave according to the rules that we behave by. And so, you know, there's this notion that, well, basically, the robot that's interacting with the person is going to set the user interface. People don't know what to do. You know, there are these amazing videos of research at Carnegie Mellon from a long time back, and it's a little trash can robot, and they're surreptitiously videotaping it while it goes and waits in line for coffee. And people are looking at it like, am I going to stand behind this thing? Am I? It had change on top and a note that says, like, you know, give me a coffee. Or there's other video where it's getting inside of an elevator, you know? Yeah. And people are looking at it, like, how far away do I stand from it, you know? And these are actual questions that we don't know. And I think what's going to happen is the people who design robots are going to have to design them to tell us. Mm. It's not okay to push me down and get coffee in front of me in line, you know? Because if you don't, then people, they're going to behave randomly.
How do some of your characters, they sort of blur the line between human and robot? Tell us about your thought process in that.
Sure. I mean, I really love thinking about this sort of journey that we all make with technology as we adapt to it. And so, you know, in Robogenesis, I have, for instance, I have a character who has prosthetic eyes, you know, so she's got essentially retinal implants. And for instance, on her journey, she can't really see human beings the way that we see each other anymore. She sees people the way a machine would see. And so as a result, she starts to lose her, you know, identity as a human being. She starts to experience the world more like a machine, and she ends up, you know, sympathizing with machines more than people. And you got to wonder how incorporating all this technology into our bodies will affect our sense of what it means to be human. Even now, people have kind of changed their feelings about, for instance, getting prosthetic limbs. It's not something to be ashamed of as much as it used to be. It's you can get something that's actually better than the limb that you had before. You get titanium, you get amazing materials and capabilities. And people are starting to think of their bodies as something that you can upgrade. And it's a fundamental shift in thinking, you know, and it's only here because of the new technology that's available.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about robotics with Daniel H. Wilson, author of Robogenesis. Yes, over here. Question.
I was going to just add to what you were saying about prosthetics. I think that that's the frontier, the earliest frontier, is how do you help people to become better at what they do? You know, and then the question comes up is, how, you know, if I can afford to upgrade myself, you know, what class am I in? And when you talk about robots taking over, it may not be an autonomous robot. It may actually be a class of people who are like super people.
Yeah, I mean, so that's a topic I definitely covered in Amped. And a lot of people think if there's this technology that's a neural implant, it's going to make me super smart, or it's going to make me better at my job, then all the rich people are going to go get it. And the way I really feel is the way that the technology is actually developing is, like I said, it's a big hurdle to get a hole drilled in your skull. And the people who are getting this technology are people who are going to see a significant benefit from having it. And, you know, what's interesting is when a person who has a severe disability gets a piece of technology because they need it, and they're willing to really risk a lot in order to have it, but then instead of restoring them to normal functioning, they leapfrog beyond normal functioning, and suddenly the kid with the learning disability is the smartest kid in the class. And, you know, thinking about how society is going to react to that is really fascinating, because it's tough. You don't want to tell somebody you have to have a disability because it threatens me that you're too smart if you get this. And then eventually, over time, I think all of these sorts of medical treatments, they get easier and cheaper, and then they proliferate, and then you have kids just using you know, ADHD drugs to study for their college courses. So we've got that in our future, except with implants. You know?
Wow. We've seen a few sci-fi films where artificial intelligence doesn't have a body, like mm-hmm. Her, Transcendence. Do you think that you have to have a body? Does a robot have to have a body? Can you?
No, of course not. You know? I mean, yeah, I think a body is really overrated in general. It might be my own perspective. But, Yeah, I mean, a lot of these different AIs are running on all kinds of different architectures, and a lot of them are very single-minded. So an AI will be designed to solve one problem. Like, for instance, this is an example I like, analog brakes. There are neural networks that are looking at, the only thing they sense is stuff that your car is sensing, like your the inertial measurement unit. And then all it decides is how to brake the car so that, you know, you don't skid. And this is an AI that doesn't have any sort of traditional body the way we think of it. And it's around us all the time and we just don't have any idea.
Yeah. You wrote a book called How to Survive a Robot Uprising.
It's a theme here, huh?
What's your number one survival tip for all of us who might have to face that situation?
Oh, yeah. It's only a matter of time. So my advice is always go for the sensors first. So, yeah. They're the most delicate and the easiest to mess up, and that'll give you time to run away.
All right. That's it. That's our tip for the day. Thank you, Daniel H. Wilson, bestselling author of Robopocalypse and Robogenesis. Both are on sale now, and you can read an excerpt from Robogenesis on our website at sciencefriday.com/robotwar. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much, Ira.